It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Got lots to cover, and just 28 minutes left.
Yeah, welcome to headline news.
All right, well, let's give it a try. Starting with international, Bagram Air Force Base.
Yeah, Bagram, Afghanistan. Interesting report in the New York Times a few days ago, which did not get much attention in other media. Basically exposing Bagram as what is being called the son of Gitmo. It is the prison where the Bush administration started sending war on terror prisoners once the courts ruled in 2004 that prisoners in Guantanamo Bay had constitutional rights to due process. Of course, that's been overturned by an act of Congress in the last few months, so those prisoners won't have access to due process after all. But in the meantime, you've got between 500 and 600 prisoners who have also been sent to this place called Bagram, where conditions are reportedly even worse than they are in Guantanamo, where the prisoners are completely cut off from the outside world. Nobody knows who is in there. They are clearly being tortured, according to the International Red Cross, which is the only organization which has been allowed into the base and been allowed any access at all to the prisoners. It's really quite a scary situation. It seems to be an intentional effort by the Bush administration once again to replicate the same situation that was in Guantanamo in the early days after the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, which is that they were in a legal void. They weren't considered prisoners of war. They weren't being covered by the Geneva Convention. They didn't have any access to due process in the American courts, so they couldn't challenge the rationale by which they were being held indefinitely. So again, we have the Bush administration insisting that they have a right to detain people indefinitely without necessarily any evidence that these folks pose any risk or have done anything wrong. A lot of the people at Guantanamo Bay, it's already been proven, are pretty much innocent of any wrongdoing, but they're still being held there by the United States. At the same time, the U.S. Department of Justice was in court this week arguing in the case of a lawsuit by a former Guantanamo Bay detainee alleging torture, and the U.S. Department of Justice was arguing that the bill that was passed, that was pushed by Senator John McCain last December, that was signed by President Bush in that infamous signing statement where he said he wouldn't go along with it because he was above the law, that the U.S. Department of Justice is arguing that that law does not apply to Guantanamo, that Guantanamo is exempt from the ban on torture. Now, this is particularly interesting because why would the U.S. make that argument in court unless the guy had been tortured? If he hadn't been tortured, then the U.S. would simply argue that, no, this guy is wrong. He did not torture, in the infamous words of George Bush, we do not torture. So this was basically an admission in court by the U.S. Department of Justice that we do torture. Is something everybody knew, except the White House wasn't admitting it, but now we've got the U.S. government admitting it as well. So that was a sad little footnote to the week.
All right. Well, and plenty happening in Iraq this week.
Yeah, we have. Let's start first with what was happening not in Iraq but about Iraq. A number of reports came out this week that were of interest. Two of them claiming that two reports had been delivered to Bush before the invasion of Iraq that cast doubt, one on the administration's claims of weapons of mass destruction and the other on Iraq's links to al-Qaeda, saying what this means essentially was that George Bush knew several months before the invasion that his intelligence agencies, his State Department, did not believe that these claims were true. And yet he and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and everybody else in the administration kept making those, Colin Powell, kept making those claims right up to and after the invasion. So more evidence, as if we ever needed it, that they were lying through their teeth all the way to sell the war, basically. Another report that came out this week saying that intelligence analysts were warning for more than 2 years that the insurgency in Iraq could turn into a civil war, which, of course, is exactly what it is in the process of now doing. And finally, there was a report from the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction saying that the post-invasion planning, that is, the planning for how the U.S. would occupy Iraq after it took Baghdad and toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein, was, quote, almost non-existent. So they made all their planning for the invasion itself. They didn't do any planning for what would happen. Now that you own it, what are you going to do with it? We've seen the results of that. In Iraq itself this week, Counterspin mentioned this. There was a Zoghbi poll. 72% of Iraq troops want to pull out in 2006. 29% want to pull out right now, which are numbers actually even a little bit higher in terms of the 72% than the general American public, which is fairly interesting. Even more interesting, and Counterspin didn't mention this, was that Zoghbi asked soldiers why they think the United States was in Iraq. 85% think we're there mainly, quote, to retaliate for Saddam's role in the 9/11 attacks, which tells you an awful lot about how successful that particular propaganda campaign was, not just from the Bush White House, but also from the military in indoctrinating their soldiers. 93% of soldiers thought that the invasion of Iraq had nothing whatsoever to do with weapons of mass destruction. And only 24% thought that the invasion had anything to do with, quote, maintaining a democracy that can be a model for the Arab world. Even fewer, 11% thought it was about oil, 6% thought it was about maintaining permanent American air bases. So a real interesting poll there. Meantime, finally, there were some developments among Iraqis this week. Of course, the violence was continuing as the fallout from the shrine in Samarra that was bombed on February 22nd. That death toll across the country is now 1,400 since the bombing. People killed in sectarian violence, mainly Sunnis, but also Shiites. There's an awful lot of sorting out of the population going on, formerly mixed neighborhoods or cities or towns, where the Sunnis are being forced out of the Shiite neighborhoods or vice versa. And the violence continues. There's a ban on cars again in Baghdad today. Travel. There's a curfew in effect again, and yet the violence is still continuing. At the same time, there were political developments and the further fracturing of the Iraq government. They're still trying to form a government after the December 15th elections. The United States had been pushing very hard for a so-called unity government that would include Sunnis as well as Shiites and Kurds. That is simply not happening. There was a petition this week from the leaders of all of the non-Shiite factions that could be a potential part of the government, from the Sunnis, from the Kurds, and from the secular folks, Ayatollahi and those people like that, petitioning that Ibrahim al-Jafari, who was the former prime minister under the old government, who wants very much to be prime minister again, they were petitioning that he not be named prime minister, particularly because of concerns over the actions of the interior ministry, the police forces, that death squads had been run, that the torture had been taking place, and so forth. The Shiites, however, are saying that al-Jafari is their guy. They're pushing hard for him to be prime minister. So you've got that split going on as well. That makes it increasingly likely that there's going to be any kind of unity government in Iraq, and increasingly likely that there's going to be one that's dominated by Shiites, and that is going to be part of the problem in terms of fomenting civil war between Shiites and Sunnis.
Meanwhile,
yes,
in two nearby countries, Pakistan and India, George Bush was visiting and negotiating on behalf of our country.
Yeah, 100,000 people turned out in New Delhi to protest George Bush. There were riots. People were killed in both India and Pakistan during various riots and protests that have attended to Bush's visit there. In India, Bush had the absolute nerve to go and lay a wreath at the New Delhi Memorial for Mahatma or Mohandas Gandhi. The most violent man in the 21st century, paying homage to the apostle of nonviolence in the early part of the 20th century. And of course, the other major difference between the two is that the Bush is an oppressor, and Gandhi was a champion of the oppressed. So I'm sure they would have had a lot to say to each other if they had ever met, none of which Bush is probably aware of. Just an incredibly arrogant and patronizing and offensive gesture by Bush that probably went right over the head of the White House people, who thought it would be a nice photo op. At the same time, he then turns around, signs a nuclear deal with India, supporting not only their nuclear energy program but also their nuclear weaponry program, and then turns around and goes directly to Pakistan. This is a guy who seems to know absolutely nothing about the subcontinent, that, for instance, Pakistan and Pakistanis might actually take offense that the guy has just helped the nuclear program of their mortal enemy.
Countries that have come close to nuclear war
in the last 3 years. Yeah. So we are, as was evidenced by the Katrina video, which I'll talk about in a minute, we are led by a genuinely clueless individual. It's really appalling.
All right. Well, and speaking of nuclear, the IAEA. E-I-E-I-O.
Yeah, International Atomic Energy Agency, for people who are not up on their acronyms. And this is the agency that has been at the diplomatic heart of the squabbling over Iran in the past year and a half, 2 years or so. That's been coming to a head thanks to pressure from the United States. In February, the IAEA voted to refer Iran and its intransigence around its alleged nuclear weapons development to the United Nations Security Council. That action has not been taken yet. On Monday, day after tomorrow, the IAEA is going to meet again and going to discuss referral to the United Nations and what it would like the United Nations to actually do. Now, at the last minute, Iran approached the Russia and the European Union this week, trying to resume negotiations after Iran had started low-level uranium enrichment. Neither Russia nor the EU would cut any kind of a deal with Iran until Iran stops the uranium enrichment. However, there are negotiations going on with Russia that uranium enrichment could continue on Russian soil under Russian supervision rather than Iran, and that way Iran could continue to develop its nuclear energy program, but there would be international control over its uranium enrichment, so that it could not be used for weapons. This is diplomatic squabbling that's going on in advance of what's expected to be a real strong United States push for some sort of sanctions against Iran. And of course, this is all about Washington's legitimation for a potential military strike against Iran, which, given how poorly the White House is doing in the polls right now, you could argue that either way, that they wouldn't dare contemplate any kind of military strike because it would be so unpopular, or that they're so deluded that they think that this would actually rally the country and restore their popularity. So, we'll see what happens in 2006, but we've got to keep an eye on Iran, and we've got to start making the public case that any kind of military action against Iran, even a so-called limited military strike, is an extraordinarily dangerous and counterproductive step to take.
All right. Jumping to national, unless you have any objections.
Oh, let's go for it.
All right. The Patriot Act looks like passed this week.
Yeah, it did. The Senate was the final vote. It passed 89-10. To her credit, actually, Patty Murray was one of those 10 votes. Good for her. But Russ Feingold in the Senate, whose filibuster a couple of weeks ago to try and stop this from happening was supported by only two other senators, one Democrat, Robert Byrd, and then the independent James Jeffords of Vermont, who is retiring. This was a shameful performance on behalf of the Democrats. This was basically the same reauthorization that the Democrats justifiably had so many civil liberties concerns about in December when they stopped it from becoming law. And they went to the White House, they sought a bunch of concessions and changes in the reauthorization. They didn't get any. It's essentially the same bill. And yet all but, nine Democrats voted for it this time. Now that it was no longer in the headlines and the cameras had gone away and they had made their point about their concern about civil liberties, as we get closer to the election, you're going to see more and more of these Democrats being afraid to take any kind of steps that could be construed as soft on terrorism. And, it's just shameful. It means we have the Patriot Act again. It means that there are very disturbing new provisions that are going to become law, such as the exclusion zones for any event of quote-unquote national significance, basically meaning any major, government leader or corporation or trade summit that comes to town, the Secret Service and the federal law enforcement can set up exclusion zones for as far away from the event as they choose that would ban protests, so that the no protest zone during the WTO, for example, would have been completely legal under the new Patriot Act. That's what just became law. That's what Maria Cantwell and all those other Democrats signed off on. It's just shameful.
Yeah, there were 16 provisions that were supposed to expire, originally had sunset clauses on them, and now because of this, they've made 14 of the 16 permanent.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it's just horrible.
Moving along, there was a couple pieces of video that came out this week, surprisingly enough.
Several of them having to do with the run-up to the Hurricane Katrina last fall. And these actually did not have much new, if any, new information in them. Congress had the transcripts of all of these various meetings and other things that were caught on video months ago. But the images themselves are absolutely compelling, particularly the meeting between people at the National Hurricane Center and FEMA, poor Michael Brown. There's a phrase I never thought would leave my lips. And, various other people on one end, and then President Bush vacationing in Crawford, Texas at the other. And Bush is sitting there very passively, no questions, no queries, no decisions, no orders, listening to, people talk about this is going to be far worse than Hurricane Andrew. The levees could break. They were concerned about the Superdome being a bad place for refugees from the storm, that it would possibly create problems, anticipating most all of the things that actually did happen. So Bush knew about all of this ahead of time. He knew that the levees might break when he said 4 days later that nobody could have anticipated that the levees would break. He was lying through his teeth, and this video proves that, basically. It's just a horrifying, gut-wrenching video to watch when you know the rest of the story, when you know what happened. And I can't imagine what former New Orleans families now living in Houston or Little Rock or Worcester or L.A. or wherever watching this video, who lost loved ones, who lost everything, whose city is never going to be the same, who know about all of the Republican cronyism that's taken place and the broken promises and the rebuilding effort, what they're thinking in the aftermath of Katrina. It's a reminder once again of how inept, how incompetent, and how absolutely detached President Bush has been and his administration under him, that they couldn't bother being mobilized for this kind of a natural disaster.
All right, and also this week, Randy Duke Cunningham.
Yeah, he actually got sentenced yesterday for his what was called by prosecutors probably accurately the worst case of corruption by any standing or former member of Congress in American history. He spent somewhere between 3 and 5 years taking massive bribes, as well as expensive gifts, yachts, houses, jewelry, all kinds of stuff from various military contractors who he procured lucrative contracts for. He got 8 years, 4 months, also $3.7 million in restitution and fines. But the kicker of this was a priceless quote from the judge, who said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, that the tragic part of all of this, Mr. Cunningham, is that you could have retired anytime you want and made a similar fortune and it would have been completely legal. And of course, the judge is absolutely right. This is exactly what all kinds of former members of Congress Congress do, including, I might add, Slade Gorton, who has made himself quite a bit richer since he lost to Maria Cantwell 6 years ago. This is the tragedy of Congress, not that Randy Cunningham, who is the exception because he did it while he was a sitting member of Congress and was greedy enough to take a lot of cash and get caught at it, but despite trading campaign donations for votes, which is pretty routine in Congress right now, you have this revolving door. You have people trading in on the fact that they have personal relationships with all these members of Congress and their aides and yada yada yada. It's an incredibly, incredibly corrupt culture, and it's gotten much worse under Republican control.
Well, I saw also tied to that in the information that's been coming out that Catherine Harris has also been cashing in a bit. She's got like somewhere $50,000 to $80,000 from the same people that were giving Cunningham money.
Yes, and Brent Wilkes and some of the other quote unquote businessmen that are tied to the Cunningham case. They're also tied into Tom DeLay and the Jack Abramoff scandal. It's like all of these people know each other, and it's to use the phrase, it is a culture of corruption. And it doesn't look like that many members of Congress past Cunningham and Bob Nye and maybe a few others will get sucked up in the Abramoff scandal. But there are many, many dozens of Congress people who are guilty of trading campaign donations for votes with Jack Abramoff, and in terms of from other major donors, because remember, Abramoff is only one of tens of thousands of lobbyists on Capitol Hill. You can pretty much count every member of Congress in that boat.
All right, I want to jump to local, and we'll come back to national if there's time. But
okay,
still plenty
that's
to
good.
Cover. All right, looks like this week OneReel announced that it's pulling out this year for the Summer Nights concert series.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge victory for neighborhood activists in Wallingford, the group Friends of Gasworks Park, which had filed a lawsuit last week to try and stop the concert series. Basically, OneReel looked at that lawsuit, looked at the time that had left to fight it before it had to start booking bands and issuing tickets, selling tickets and so forth, and said, we can't just do that this year. Of course, they and the city are still absolutely committed to holding their concerts in Gasworks Park in 2007, so the lawsuit is going to go ahead. The organizing is going to continue to try and stop that series from happening, not just because neighbors in Wallingford object to the noise and the traffic and the parking and so forth, all of which is true. That can be mitigated, though. The real issue is whether a commercial enterprise like this is an appropriate use of a park to take a neighborhood park, in fact, the only green space in one of the most crowded neighborhoods in the city, and essentially block off a big chunk of it for an entire summer the stage and the stands and bleachers and the porta potties and the backstage area and all the rest of it are blocked off from use by anybody else so that this commercial enterprise can go forward. And we've seen a lot of these movements. So as I talked about last week, and I wrote this week in the weekly, what's interesting is that the victory at Gasworks Park has given tremendous momentum, not just to the various organizations that are fighting the Parks Department on various controversies, but all sorts of neighborhood groups. The Queen Anne folks that I mentioned that have been fighting the Metropolitan Market issue on Queen Anne Hill, some of the U District development that's going on, folks at Northgate. And there's talks going on right now of forming a new citywide neighborhood advocacy group that could potentially become a force in city politics. We're about due for one of the periodic neighborhood revolts that we see in the city, that we've seen with Vision Seattle, again with the Civic Foundation, again with Charlie Chong about a decade ago. You could even throw the monorail into that category. We're about due again for some sort of revolt that's based on resentment of Greg Nickels and the very top-down policies from City Hall that are all about developers, that are all about making decisions and then telling neighborhoods what's going to happen there. Al Runty, last November, member got a surprisingly large chunk of the vote for having no money and no name recognition, basically because people resented the development agenda of Greg Nichols, and Runty talked about that.
All right, and at the state level, Washington State Legislature is getting close to wrapping things up, but there's still time.
Yeah, today is actually a major deadline for bills moving forward. So if folks have bills that they're passionate about or issues that they care about, today would be a good day to call your legislators in Olympia and tell them that you want particular things passed or not passed. Probably the most important of those that faces the deadline today is funding for the Sonics. They cut a new proposal on Thursday because it was pretty clear that the idea of they're not contributing any money whatsoever to a new basketball arena where Key Arena now stands was not going to fly. So the idea now is not $400 million for a brand new arena, but the taxpayers would contribute $176 million. The Sonics would contribute something. The Sonics would still get all of the profits from the new arena, however. It's still not a very good deal. As with Gasworks Park, where the media coverage was just horrible in the daily papers, you got media coverage that was basically, those horrible people in the neighborhood, those NIMBYs, they're taking away our right to our music. You're also getting that kind of coverage around the Sonics because newspapers and television stations make a lot of money from sports. They don't want to see the basketball team go. So bear that in mind when you read articles about this issue. But today's a key deadline for that.
And they have operators that are available to take your calls from 9 to 1 on Saturdays. And the number to express any of your viewpoints on any of the issues is 1-800-562-6000. 1-800-562-6000. Operators will be standing by in about 5 minutes.
Get those fingers busy.
All right. So, very, very quickly, school district.
Yeah, a couple big decisions this week. The school board announced that it wants to save $5 million by closing 12 schools in 2007. It said where in different parts of town those will be, but not which schools those will be. The targets and starting to talk about the criteria will happen in a board meeting on March 15th. So get busy if you're concerned about that. Also, there was an interesting 4-3 vote, surprising vote by the board this week that shot down a plan to have high school students use city buses rather than the traditional yellow buses to ship students to school. This was a combination of a question of union politics because of the school bus drivers that would be out of work because of this. Also a question of how much money would actually be saved. There was a question of that. There was a question of student safety on city buses. Who would cover for the cost of additional city buses if they were needed, various questions that were just unresolved. So Sally Soriano and several other progressives on the school board voted against this, and it went down.
All right. Well, talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
These stories and many more can be found when we publish every couple of weeks at it's a free publication that comes out at bookstores and cafes, places around town, the King County Library System. It's also on the web, as are all our past issues, at www.eatthestate.org. We also have a blog with breaking issues and commentary as it comes out each day. We rely on donations. We rely on volunteers. We rely on people who offer feedback and help us distribute and help us proofread and edit and sell ads and all those things. If you want to help out, if you want to just tell us what you think we're doing, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.